Hey, Cam.
Hey Nathan, how are you?
Is the Aries call already all wrapped up?
I believe so. Oh, I left a bit early to prepare for this meeting.
Okay. I didn't hit the Aries call today. I had a conflict, so I did my other Kiva meetings.
Yeah, that's okay. We just went over proof of did ownership.
Hello.
And hey Hart, how are you?
Hey guys. Yeah, how are you all?
Doing well, thank you.
Awesome. I have something for you all. I meant to send this to you, but I forgot. I did ask about private set intersection. Let me find the response. There we go. Let me forward you all the response. CamiloP@kiva.com, right?
Yep. Dot org, sorry. Did you send it to dot org?
Yes, I'm
Okay,
sending it
cool.
right now. I'm also sending it to Nathan.
Sweet.
So these are the I asked somebody about it, and they gave me like two references they thought were the best. So you all can check those out. Sorry, I meant to like send this along, but I dropped the ball.
That's okay. I thought we could continue our discussion today about private set or PSIs, yeah. And maybe you can give us some more insight from what you got.
Yeah. So why don't I sent you that mail. I will pull up the actual links.
Oh, Brent's here.
Also have to leave at 8:30, unfortunately.
Okay.
I have four meetings scheduled for this hour, so oops.
Well, I'm glad you chose ours to do first.
So that's not the greatest, but all right. So there's one paper. This is the newer one, I think. This is probably the one to go over. This has a comparison of lots of different protocols.
That's actually sounds like from the title, it sounds like what I wanted to talk about because the more I look into private set intersection, it seems like there are less and less use cases for us, at least, because it doesn't seem like it's scalable or the scalable solutions are correlatable.
Yeah, so it depends on how you define sort of like what scalability do you need, right?
Right. Let's say we wanted to do like implement this for revocation, right? And you would have millions of entries in a set that this, PSI probably wouldn't be the best solution for it.
Yeah, so you have to I mean, as you point out, the correlation is interesting, right? Because basically this is like one of those things where you have to make sure you like don't move too fast. Like if your protocol is too fast, right? You can sometimes effectively distinguish. Like, not always, but so I mean, here this paper is claiming some pretty good scalability.
Is how I saw Visa, I think it is that they gave a talk about it. They were hashing their set,
You know who gave the
their
talk
larger
at
set.
Visa?
I don't remember. I can see it. But they were talking about hashing it and using I think cuckoo sorting, mm-hmm. and they mentioned that while it was, it made it scalable, it was, if it wasn't done correctly, it would be correlatable.
Yeah, I mean, you have to pick which things you protect against, right? Because protecting against everything just becomes too expensive.
I think it was Peter Rindall.
If you have a link,
yeah,
you can add it to the notes for the meeting.
What was that?
If you have a link to whatever, you know, paper or documentation you have from it, add it to the links to the meeting.
I will do.
I don't know. I'm to the point where I have to catch up on some of these papers before I have much more opinions on it.
You want me to? I mean, if you want, like, I can probably email Peter. I mean, I know Peter well enough to email him.
That would be cool. Definitely. Well, I'm more interested on the privacy of Cuckoo and seeing if it is possible.
So I guess, like, can you state in like a cryptographic definition what privacy properties you want?
Let's see.
Yeah, this paper also covers Cuckoo hashing.
There's also there's another type of sorting that can be used that I went over this that I read about, but for the properties that we would want for revocation, that's like it's a tough on the spot question. I guess we're trying to keep both sets as private as they can as they can be, and
I mean, like, and that is like, well, you're certainly not gonna attempt to, like, I would be surprised if you were going to try to hide the set size, for instance, right?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you are, but that gets very complicated very fast. It is very difficult. So you leak the set size. You probably also leak the intersection size, right?
Right.
So right off the bat, like, you're leaking like the deltas in the operation, right? So if I run like a set intersection with you like twice at two different times, right? Then I can sort of know how many things you've like added that are in the intersection, right?
Right.
And this is a problem, right? If I like if I query you after every update, right? Like, that's a problem for you, right?
Right.
Or it could potentially be a problem. So you know, if you're in this like multiple query model, you need to have some kind of definition, like where, you know, an adversary only sort of learns like the deltas or something, right?
Right. So no matter what you would, so what you're saying is no matter what we would do, if we implemented something like PSI, there would always be leakage in some area.
Yeah, there's always some leakage, right? I mean,
right.
Like, you know, like, this kind of thing is extremely hard, right? You know, you're getting into essentially like traffic analysis style problems, right?
Right.
And this is like extremely difficult to mitigate. But, you know, maybe this leakage is okay, right?
Right. Yeah. I don't see why it would be, I guess it wouldn't be a problem for people to know the size of the set. Especially if it's something like a public set, like you have one private set and one public set.
Well, but they also might learn the size of the intersection, right?
Right.
So that's probably okay to learn too, right?
Yeah, yeah. As long as that data is not correlatable to you know, the private, the person who wants to keep their set private, or if both people want to, or both parties want to keep their sets private or whatever.
Well, I mean, the other thing is like what externally is also going on with these sets, right?
Right.
It's probably fine if there's like no outside information, right? But
it never really works that way.
What?
It never really works.
Yeah, there's always outside information. So like, yeah. So if you want to do this, like the first thing to do is to think about what security you need, right?
Yeah.
So like, what exactly does uncorrelatability mean, right?
Yeah, which pieces of data in the protocol require to be non-correlatable? What's considered part of the scope of blinding and what's not?
Yeah.
And which secrets do you anchor those things to? And how do you make sure that entropy is set up so that it's fair and no malicious party can destroy the guarantees for their counterparties?
Yeah, so this is the important thing is defining the model. And once you have the model, then we can think about a protocol, right? And somebody mm-hmm. may have already done the protocol for you, right?
Right.
This is like, my experience is that like, you know, good security professionals and applied cryptographers like pick the and fix the security definitions before they start worrying about how to implement them. Whereas sort of the less good people don't commit to definitions and just sort of throw solutions at the problem. So really.
Right. Yeah. With a pile of protocols that don't necessarily
match. Yeah. And they may do something, but they may not. So.
Right.
Cam, do we have a notes page or an agenda page for the meeting today? I couldn't find one on the wiki when I went looking.
No, I still don't know how to make one. And so I need to figure that out.
So are you in? Go to wiki.hyperledger.org. We can do this live. And log in. And then go to the URSA page. Do you know how to get to the URSA page?
Cam, I think you're the one he's teaching here.
Cam?
Sorry about that. I was muted.
No worries. So go to this page. Right there, I posted in the chat.
Right.
And then on the far left, there should be a meeting agendas and notes.
Yep.
And then you click on meeting agendas, meeting notes. And then once you go in there, at the top toolbar, there's a big create button. Do you see that? Cam?
Yeah, I don't. Oh, yeah, I see the create. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
And you can basically put whatever you want in this wiki. So.
All right, cool.
You want to like change the format? Totally fine. I did not do a particularly good job with this. So feel free to, you know. Feel free to change it up.
Well, one of my questions for this meeting where we didn't have a fixed agenda, has everyone had a chance to read through breaking unlinkability in Identity Mixer using malicious keys?
Yes.
Brent, have you seen that paper? Have you read through it?
I have heard of the paper, but I have not read it.
Okay.
What are your thoughts, Nathan?
Well, it breaks the link of unlinkability, meaning that you can observe M1, but it does not break the fact that M1 should be a blinded pseudonym, so far as I can tell. So effectively, the issuer is just saying, I've given you bad primes such that I have compromised my own guarantee of presentation unlinkability. And the danger here is that they can break that unlinkability and tell the verifiers that, but not tell you as the holder. And the simple fix that struck me is we should add something to the credential definition that's anchored on chain that makes them prove that they've used sufficiently good primes without revealing those primes, obviously.
Yeah, that was the proposed fix, right?
And then my question was, does the current indie credential definition already include something sufficient for that? And I don't know the answer to that question.
So there is a issuer setup correctness proof.
Yes.
Is that what we're talking about, or is that something different?
That is what I'm talking about. And the question is that sufficient?
That's sufficient, yeah.
To prove that they've picked P and Q well enough.
And if not, we should just add it.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know that I'm qualified to say whether
this... Where is this, Nathan? Is this an indie?
Yeah, so it would be the credential definition that's anchored on the indie chain. Where would that be in the URSA code, Cam? Because the URSA code should have the correctness proof generation code in it.
I mean, I have the paper that describes it. I have the math in front of me right now.
Which paper are you looking at, Brent?
It's the Anon Creds. It's anonymous credentials with type 3 replication.
Okay, I'm betting we don't do it because the Itamix paper doesn't do it. And this is based on the Itamix paper.
There are a number of places that we modified and changed. We went from Itamix to do things like this. So
okay.
It wouldn't surprise me if this is something that we were like, you know, this should be done.
Gotcha.
But the issue itself is in URSA, right, Nathan? That's I don't know where to point you to it, but it was reported in URSA.
Yeah. So these guys did say it was in URSA.
It's fair to log this against URSA. And in fact, they're saying that they haven't, of course, shared it with us, but there's the paper says code demonstrating this attack against Hyperledger URSA, and the IRMA implementations is available and can be found at. So whenever the disclosure window opens, they would, you know, the paper indicates they will be publishing the code that demonstrates the linkability attack against URSA.
Would this be mitigated in the implementation where in the indie layer?
It should, and that's what I was diving at with my question is, I think that the proof Brent refers to, or I'm suspicious the proof Brent refers to has enough data that it could mitigate this attack, but we would need to make sure that the check is obvious, and that we've verified that it actually protects against what the paper is describing. Because my guess is you could exploit a raw URSA implementation because it wouldn't have a sufficient oracle.
Yeah.
But it could be that our indie correctness proof, the setup correctness proof isn't enough. Like we might not do enough we might make it so that the exploit is still possible, but a lot harder, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is just general, right? Like the exploit they specifically described is sort of just one way of exploiting the fact that,
right,
you know, the issuer modulus is not well formed.
Yeah, so. And I'm suspicious that we would, with the correctness proof, we would still be vulnerable, but you'd have to craft one that passed the correctness proof.
Well, the point is you shouldn't be able to pass the correctness proof, right?
Yeah.
Unless you're like, yeah.
But because we didn't specifically try to protect against it, I'm still suspicious of it.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if the check didn't quite work. that we have in place. So,
but the question is, as a group, how do we organize figuring out whether that's true or not? Because that's what we need to respond to the paper and respond to the offer.
We need to get to the code, right? I mean, it's just a, like, are we doing it? Like, where's the check? And is the check checking that these, like, I don't know what to call them, like the things that should be prime are actually prime, basically, right?
So how do we want to go about that? I mean, if the four of us don't do it, I don't think anyone's going to do it. So how do we organize this?
Yeah, I mean, can first we need to find it in the code, right? So let's find all the checks that we have in the code. And then, like, once we know where they are, we can take a look, right? Is that reasonable?
Do we want to just set it as for next week to have that as a task, or in the next meeting to have that as a task for everybody to come with their findings?
Yeah, I mean, but if you guys find it, can you send it out? And then we can, like, look at it. I mean, if I know where it is in, like, I don't know precisely where it is in code, but if we know where it is in code, like, checking the, like, seeing if the check is being done should be pretty straightforward, right?
Yeah, well, you have to look at the two code bases in order to completely answer this question.
Right, and I have no idea about the Indie code base.
Yeah, it's been a while for me that I actually looked into Indie SDK. But yeah, we can set that as a task. I'll write that in the notes as well. And then I guess in the next meeting, we could formalize what the findings.
Yeah, like from a response, a security issue response standpoint, we need to identify what checks in the code exist, how we believe the code should be behaving, whether we need to make a change or not. And then we should respond to the paper's authors to tell them, here's what we've done to mitigate the issue. If you have, you know, further exploits or further feedback on what we've done so far, here's our plan for responding to that.
Sorry, guys. I just cut out there. Nathan, I agree with what you just said there, but hello?
I'm still here.
Okay, sorry. My internet Zoom just crashed on me.
No worries. So I guess part of what I'm looking for here is we probably need to make sure that we've got a security. We already have a security issue logged against this, right?
Like an issue, an issue written about this?
What would be a security thing, not in the issues?
Not a regular GitHub issue, but a security.
Oh, yeah, the security, yeah, sorry. No, we don't have one logged.
Oh, we do not?
I don't believe so.
So has this been officially reported to us by any of the authors in the paper? Obviously, we got the paper from somewhere.
I thought this was being kept hush-hush.
Yeah, well, if someone notified us as the maintainers of the project, then we need to consider it an officially reported security incident.
Right, and the security advisories are private to people who are maintainers on the repository.
Right. And
we have one, but it's not related to this.
Okay, so this is a different thing. Okay, yeah, what I'm looking for is someone to volunteer to take the lead on responding to that security issue. And with what we need to do is we need to check the setup verification of the issuers of the issuer to see how much are we exposed in the actually deployed environment. And that's going to take some footwork of diving into the code and probably trying some of the things outlined in the paper.
None of the Anoncred's demos do the issuer correctness proof that I can see.
Which would be why I think they would use the IRSA code to show the vulnerability. Yeah. And then the question is, do any of the active implementations like ACAPI, are they triggering the issuance correctness proof?
Yeah, I'm not seeing, I guess what I'm saying is I'm not seeing that implemented in Indy.
Wow.
I'm not saying it's not there. I'm just saying I haven't found it yet.
Guys, I actually have to drop. Let me know what I need to do as a result of this. I'm happy to like help go over crypto stuff. So just keep me posted. And sorry, I have to leave early.
No worries.
Thanks, Hart.
And yeah, I'm trying to bring in some more academic cryptographers to this group. We will see what I can do. So thank you all so much. If you can
convince Mike, that would be great.
You might be too busy. But thanks a lot for your time. And I'll talk to you all later. And yeah, mail me with any follow-ups.
Thanks, Art.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
So we not only want to check this in Indy, but also in ACAPI and possibly the other implementations of Aries. Is that what you're saying, Nathan?
Well, we're looking for what the actual CVE exposure is. Is this an exploit that someone could use in the wild? For example, for us at Kiva, could the issuer intentionally choose bad credential definition keys to make it so that presentations of their government ID card were relinkable without the holder's knowledge? So you're going about thinking, oh, every time I present this, you can't correlate me, when in reality, all the verifiers are correlating you with everyone everywhere, and then using that to build their, you know, the government's out to get you database.
Right.
You know, what's the practical exposure on this attack? So that when we say, here's the fix, we can also say, here's how severe the issue is, and here's who needs to hurry and update. Now I'm trying to figure out where I got the PDF from, because I Google email search is having trouble finding it in my email inbox. I have it printed out sitting here on my desk, but I'm trying to figure
out. You got it from me in Slack.
I'm trying to make sure it has a copy.
I am seeing no function in Indy SDK that indicates that this is coded anywhere. But I was also just running through the different test folders. It might theoretically exist elsewhere and in the actual code and just not be tested.
I could also really easily see us having skipped that implementation.
Because
the whole premise here is you have a malicious issuer and malicious verifiers.
Yeah, I guess I can take on that task of putting the issue together, or the security report together. I do need to read. I haven't read the item mix paper. Brent, you don't have a copy of that?
I have a copy of the Itemix paper somewhere.
Okay.
I mean, but I don't care about the Itemix paper because we only vaguely, I mean, we didn't implement the Itemix paper. We implemented a paper based on the Itemix paper.
Yeah.
It does they say we have code that shows this works against URSA.
Well, it sounds to me like CAM can probably do some of the trying to track down what code implementation exists, but we're going to need someone to help on the is this right part, because I don't think CAM or I are not prepared to be able to answer that question with any correctness or validity.
I think first step is to verify that this does not actually exist in the code anywhere. I think I'm not seeing it anywhere. We go right from indie issuer create credential offer to indie prover create credential request. There is no indie prover validate issuer setup or anything like that. That function does not exist that I can find anywhere.
Yeah. Actually, that doesn't, as I went through an on-creds, like when I was doing some work on DM, I never saw that.
Well, and it would be a step that the holder should probably run this check before they accept a credential to say, yeah, are you giving me an actual anonymous credential or are you giving me a pseudo-anonymous credential?
Right. So assuming that it's not in the code, which I would be amazed that it was, I think the next step is to say, okay, here is the correctness proof mitigation that we have. Is this sufficient? You know, should we code against this? Would this actually be sufficient to prevent this attack? You know, I don't know if Hart would be able to look at it or we would need to find somebody else, but.
Well, and the other thing that I want to make sure of is my understanding is that this allows them to correlate M1. It does not crack the value that's inside of M1, which should be a blinded link secret. So you can unmask the pseudonym, but you can't unmask the root secret behind the pseudonym.
Right. So if I use a different blinding for every credential issuance,
which you should.
Should, then.
This shouldn't break any. The issuer is intentionally breaking a property that they're providing to you. They're not breaking anything beyond their own credential.
Right.
The danger being they break it in a way that you should be able to notice, but we're not. Right now, we're not noticing.
Okay, so keep looking in the code. I mean, I've got Indie SDK anon creds open right now. I don't see it in there. Where else should we ought to look? I mean, how far away from the source problem are we going to look for this?
I think for this group, we should just focus on does the function to check validity exist in URSA? And are we recommending that they use it? And obviously the second one, we know we're not recommending they use it now because first we don't think it exists. So my guess is the remediation for this is we need to add that function and recommend that everyone that consumes URSA exercise that function in as part of their protocol design.
Right, that's what we need. So I looked in the NDA. Use it. So we need to look in URSA to see if it exists in URSA.
Well, and one of the dangers we have is the function could actually exist in ARIES or in the old Indie SDK code, but somehow was not labeled as part of the cryptographic system when we moved stuff over, right? So that's the only place where I can see we would need to look at the system in aggregate is if this check existed in Indie and doesn't exist in URSA. But My suspicion from what we've seen so far and what I remember of the implementation is we probably didn't think this check was required, or we probably, or this check probably wasn't implemented because we hadn't implemented everything everything yet. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So Brent, just to make sure, you do have the breaking unlinkability in identity mixer using malicious keys paper?
That I do not have.
Oh, okay. That's the one I think we need to make sure Brent has.
Okay, cool. Yeah. I can send that to you.
Because Evernim or Avast is probably the largest deployed issuer of, or deployed toolkit issuing set of credentials.
Is it Brent.Sundell at Evernim.com?
Evernim works, Avast works, and Gmail works.
Okay.
Fancy.
Oh, yeah.
I don't have anything else to say about this. I think the next thing is we just got a lot of homework to do.
I wonder if it's part of... Okay, no. Here it is.
Ooh.
Yeah, so in the libursa srccl-prover.rs, as part of process credential signature, the prover processes the primary credential and then checks the signature correctness proof.
Okay, then the question is, does the signature correctness proof do anything to show that you've used sufficiently large primes for PNQ? Or right. Anything derived from that?
So it appears to be built into the URSA that everybody's using. So if they're able to break URSA, then we're not.
Fair enough.
But
now we know where we need to fix it.
Yeah, we do have a function that we can modify. To include these checks. So, okay, so Cam's going to create the issue. The question really is, how does the setup correctness proof need to be modified in order to protect against this attack?
The paper that was reported to us doesn't speculate, but it does seem to reference it like it's some well-known check. So I would suggest, Brent, if you want to take a look at the paper, I think section 3 in particular describes the exploit on group order.
And I just sent that to you.
In their mitigation section, they say the only foolproof mitigation is to provide a complete proof of proper generation of the public key, including showing that N is the product of exactly two safe primes. And I don't believe that that's the best way of going about this, but anything more would require more work than they were probably going to put in.
Which address did you send it to, Cam?
At Evernim.
Oh, there it is. Just showed up.
They do concede that it's sufficient, at least as a temporary measure, to confer more trust on the issuer by restricting the number of parties that are allowed to become issuers and have contractual agreements and compliance measures in place to ensure non-exploitation before the before covered weakness. So they're saying it's not, if there is some agreement, legal agreement that says you generated your keys correctly, they think that that's enough to keep an ecosystem safe as a on a temporary basis.
So people using Sovereign are okay, I guess.
Well, that would technically cover most of the current in the wild deployments, right? Because we have closed loop ecosystems where the software generating the keys for the issuer is not necessarily controlled by the issuer itself, but by the vendor that's in charge of the ecosystem as well, which balances the incentives involved. So I think for most of our pre-pilot settings, everyone's okay. There's no one who's doing kind of in the wild public network per se, beyond Sovereign and Sovereign. Well, both Sovereign and ID Union, I think, are okay with their, because of the way the issuer agreements work on those networks, you could claim they're covered anyway. I don't know that.
I guess the staging, the people who are staying in staging are probably not covered by this though, because they don't, I guess you just have to ask to be an issuer.
And like I say, as long as your software only trusts a defined set of issuers where you know their keys are good, in theory, this is not a problem for you yet, but it could be. So we want to fix it. Congratulations, we've grown up. Someone has written a vulnerability paper on the software that we maintain. At least they haven't branded it like Heartbleed yet.
Itemic specification requires no proof statements to be produced on any properties of N. So we have sufficient freedom in its choice. Okay. But the non-crits doesn't do that. I'm very curious. Such prime generation would be allowed. I need to look at in zero knowledge that a number is the product of two safe primes, written by Jan Kamenisch.
Oh, that sounds like a better paper than the one that I've had to dig through.
Well, that's the one they referenced for a mitigation or a way to prove that this is, and I don't know. Oh, don't give me the Springer link. Give me a real one.
You're saying I should look up the footnotes? Gosh, heresy.
No? All right, where's the math, Jan?
Yeah, I thought we protected against this at some point. I remember very vaguely crypto discussions early on about this issue that I didn't pay much attention to because I figured I was above my pay grade.
One thing that I dislike about the Anoncred's so-called paper is that the setup correctness proof that's just written, it doesn't say where it comes from. It's not a complete paper. It's not fully notated or properly notated.
Apologies, I have to drop off to get something done quick. Cam, will you update me on what you decide?
Yeah.
Okay, thanks, Brent.
See you guys later.